Okay, so the reason I came up with this title is that I used to be a family doctor, and I never thought in a million years that God would call me to be an obstetrician gynecologist. But God has a sense of humor, so here I am. I think one of the things that scared me the most when I was a family doctor was encountering the obstetric patient, and what would I do with that patient? So I designed this lecture for those in the audience that are not obstetrician gynecologists. When you are it on the mission field, some things to think about and some resources to use. So the objectives are to review common OBGYN emergencies in low resource settings for the purpose that you can recognize the emergencies that are occurring and you can more confidently manage those on the field. So let's start off with the big five. Have any of y'all ever been to Africa? I know there's some in the room that have been, okay. When you hear the big five, what do you think of? Okay, the safari, the lion, so what else do we have? Lion, rhino, elephant. All right, let's look at some pictures. So yes, the lion, I didn't hear the Cape buffalo. We were charged by a Cape buffalo one time. Thank goodness we were in a safari van, which could outrun the Cape buffalo. But they're pretty scary animals. The elephant, the rhino. It's my favorite joke. Why did the rhino cross the road? What is this? Good, it's a cheetah. It's not a leopard. And the leopard is actually in the big five. And I, all these years, I have never seen a leopard. And my national colleagues joke, and they said it's a sign from God that he will wait till I'm 90 years old to see a leopard, and then it's time for me to go home from Africa. So I shouldn't look too hard. Okay, the big five. When I talk about the big five in obstetrics, I'm speaking of something else in the care of women on the mission field. When we think about the big five, I like to reflect on really what the status is of maternal mortality in the world. If you look at your clocks, about every 90 seconds, a woman is dying somewhere in the world from a complication related to pregnancy. So the issue with that then becomes where are most of these mortalities occurring? And they're in low-resource settings. Many of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, which is near and dear to my heart. And what are these problems that we see? The big one is postpartum hemorrhage. I'm talking about direct causes. Women are hemorrhaging after childbirth. It's very preventable. But when women are laboring at home, they're getting to hospitals or clinics very late if they can get there at all. It is a big killer of women. Infection, sepsis, complications from abortion are very significant. When I speak of abortion in this lecture, I'm going to be using it to speak of miscarriage and abortion. In this context, though, it is speaking of unsafe abortion, and we are seeing more and more of that. Where I work in Kenya, women attempting to get abortions and having pretty horrific complications from that. Preeclampsia and eclampsia. It's a big killer of women in the developing world, and obstructed labor. So those are the big five that I'm talking about, and I want to use these as a basis to lecture this morning on what you can do as you're encountering emergencies that are centered around these things. Just to ask, do you know what the sixth cause of maternal mortality is related to pregnancy? I know there's some OBGYNs out in the... It's embolism, so DVT and embolism. It's a significant problem as well. So this morning we're going to talk about postpartum hemorrhage. We're going to talk about complications from miscarriage and abortion. I'm going to use that as a platform to talk about bleeding in pregnancy and ruptured ectopic pregnancy. Management of eclampsia, which you will see. I read in a textbook recently that it was very rare to see eclampsia in the United States. Times at Tenwick, I'm seeing women come in every day with eclampsia. It's simply not recognized. And then preeclampsia then develops into eclampsia. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about obstructed labor, cesarean section. I'll put in a plug for the simulation that we're doing tomorrow. And I want to talk about a special form of obstructed labor, shoulder dystocia. So y'all played tag when you were kids? I always hated it because I was never a fast runner. And I was always tagged. So when I was a family doctor working, I would often get tagged when I would do a short-term trip with working with obstetric patients. So I'm hoping this lecture that we're going to go over these points will help you to be a little more comfortable when you're tagged and you're it. When you see tag up on the presentation, wake up, pay close attention, because that's going to be management focus. Also, in your handout, I've included a lot of these things, so you can review those later. That's actually a handbook that we pass out at Tenwick for our interns. So postpartum hemorrhage definitions. Traditionally, we talk about vaginal deliveries greater than 500 cc's, cesarean sections greater than 1,000 cc's, but if you've ever dealt with women after they had a baby, there can be a lot of blood loss, and nobody is measuring it. How many cc's is this? So it's clinically, it's bleeding plus signs and symptoms of hypovolemia. Now, I like to keep things simple, the four T's can help you remember in an emergency situation. Uterine atony is tone. Retained placenta is tissue. Lacerations, trauma, and DIC is thrombin. The big cause of postpartum hemorrhage is which one? It's uterine atony, 80% of the causes, and this is very treatable and very preventable, and yet women are dying from it all over the world. Now, postpartum hemorrhage, who are you worried about? People who've had no antenatal care in a late presentation, who are coming in laboring, you're going to worry about them. But classically, we talk about a uterus that's over-distended, multiples. You see a lot of twins and some triplets, and especially in Africa, over-distension. We have older moms, big babies. We do have diabetes out on the mission field, and so polyhydramnios as well. A tired uterus, somebody who's been laboring for days and days and days, and that uterus gets tired, it's not going to contract down after delivery or after a C-section. Induction, we do inductions. Prolonged inductions can lead to an increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage. Subclinical infection, prolonged rupture of membranes, chorioamnionitis. Female circumcision is something that we see, which is going to lead to an increased risk for actually lacerations, which cause hemorrhage. Fibroids, the uterus won't contract down at all. History of postpartum hemorrhage, if a woman comes in and tells you, I almost died in my last three pregnancies from postpartum hemorrhage, pay attention and you can plan ahead. Okay, the typical presentation. The call from the midwife. So this is in the middle of the night. It's always after midnight, it seems. And the midwife calls you and says the woman is bleeding. Now, when you get there, truly, many times, it looks like a garden hose. And I call it the garden hose effect. You've never seen so much bleeding in your life. And it can be very overwhelming. People will be running around. People will be panicking. That's when you take your own pulse, take a deep breath, and you start to think about systematically what this could be caused by. I'm going to be focusing on early PPH. There is a late PPH after 24 hours. But women can go into shock very quickly. The placental bed, 500 to 750 cc's a minute goes through that. So a woman can bleed very rapidly if that uterus isn't contracting down. All right, tag, you're it. Management of postpartum hemorrhage. Initial assessments, you're going to remember your ABCs. Practically, I want you to remember to do something. Drain the bladder. If the bladder is really big, the uterus is not going to be able to contract down, and people forget that. So as you're getting your midwife to help you get in the IVs, as you're getting fluids on board, you're going to make sure that bladder is drained. And you're going to take your hand, and you're going to put it in the vagina up against the cervix, and you're going to grab the uterus, and you're going to push down. If you take your two fingers and put it behind the cervix, you can get the uterine arteries, and you can push that uterus down while you're trying to get the woman stabilized. If you have access to CBC, if you have access to type and cross, you're going to want to be getting someone to do this. This is a team effort. Oxygen, sometimes you have it, sometimes you don't. It's good to use if you have. And then think about your uterotonics, which I'm going to review in just a minute. Now, when all this is going on, you start thinking about a cause. And a systematic approach is essential. So first of all, uterine atony, you're thinking about your contributing factors. And your job really is to make the woman's body do what God intended to do, and that's that uterus to shrink down around the placental bed and to stop that bleeding. Now, a couple things I want to mention just briefly. Uterine inversion, that's when the uterus windsocks out. I have a picture of that. That is a separate problem, but it's when the midwife tells you something is protruding from the vagina or something looks funny and you have massive hemorrhage. So that's actually the uterus windsocking out, and placenta is usually still attached. And then you're thinking about retained products. When you're putting your hand up into the vagina, you can feel all of this. So make sure you're looking and make sure you're feeling. If you put your hand up in the uterus, you can actually sweep the uterus, and you can remove clots and any retained tissue, and that will help the uterus shrink down. Now, uterotonics. At Tenwick, we have oxytocin and I have misoprostol. And in your handouts, there are little recipes there for using your oxytocin. And then misoprostol is very inexpensive and it's cheap. And if you're going on a short-term mission trip, you can put some in your pocket and you can carry it with you. And we use it per rectal in hemorrhaging situations, because if you put it in the vagina, what happens? It floats out. You can also give it orally to patients as well. Methyl ergonovine and carbapross, I have not been able to get a hold of. I'm not sure in different parts of the world where you may be going, but they're both very good agents, and you should think about them as second line after oxytocin. Transexamic acid is also something that's being used now in different places with postpartum hemorrhage, although we have not used that in my part of the world for that purpose yet. Okay, a little bit about uterine inversion. What's the big rule when you have uterine inversion? Don't remove the placenta. That's the big thing. You remove the placenta and then your hemorrhage is going to be out of control. So you're going to stop your uterotonics, and you're going to try to manually replace the uterus. Now, has anybody ever tried to do that? Okay. Then you know how hard it is to do. Now, here's a picture of it. These pictures make it look so easy, right? There's no blood. Everybody's calm. It's just gently putting it back in. But that's what you need to do. You need to have long gloves on, a lot of KY jelly, and then you need to put your hand back, and you just try to replace it. I mentioned some uterine relaxing agents here. Nitroglycerin works really well. I don't have terbutaline where I work. And magnesium sulfate can also be helpful. General anesthesia, if it's available, sometimes you have to move to the theater. Now, we've talked a little bit already about tissue and manual exploration. I think when I was a family doctor, the thing that scared me the most was actually putting my hand up inside the uterus. I think that was just a terrifying thought for me. It works. If you can get the patient relaxed, sometimes they will need some help from your anesthesiologist, but sometimes they won't. These women are very brave, and they will cooperate. You just put your hand there. You feel for that big floppy cervix, and you put your hand right into the uterus. You're using your top hand on the abdomen, and then, again, you're sweeping. You can use some gauzes for that as well, but be careful and keep a count because you don't want to leave anything up into in the uterus. I mentioned something called a banjo, large blunt curette. That's a very large instrument that we use. It is a straight instrument with the curette on the top. What's the big risk with that? Perforation. So if you have an ultrasound, if you can get a hold of an ultrasound, it's very helpful to watch that curette go up into the uterus. Suction machines are great, but they're very rarely available in low resource settings, and many times they don't work well when you have them. You don't have the right tubing. You don't have enough suction. So I really encourage manual exploration and the large blunt curette if you can find it, and if you can be very careful and not perforate out to the sides or right up the top of the fundus. All right, trauma. This is something that's often overlooked. We've had women come in before, and people were thinking atony, and she had a massive cervical laceration, and women can pass away from this very quickly. I would just encourage you to have light. If when you're going, you think you're going to be doing any obstetrics, buy a headlamp, a really good one. It's going to help you, because one thing I find difficult where I am is I never can find enough light. So have your headlamp. Make sure you have lots of gauze and lots of hands and lots of helpers. Ring forceps, they are also a big help to have, and large speculum. Use packing and systematically pack and inspect everything, again, systematically. It's sort of a theme of this, because you can get lacerations from the labia majora, the clitoris. I've seen massive bleeding from the clitoral artery before. Up the vagina, you can have large hematomas forming. The cervix is the one that bleeds. Women come in, many times multips, they're pushing, and they push before they're fully dilated. Rips the cervix, and you have these big arteries coming down, and they bleed a lot. So we can talk a little bit more about, especially tomorrow, if y'all have questions, you want to come by, about the surgical techniques, but remember to use absorbable suture. All right, all I'm going to say about DIC and thrombin is that fresh blood works. When I first started working on the mission field, I was thinking massive transfusion protocols, platelets, various and sundry things that I had in the Western world. But when you can get fresh blood, it turns the patient around. I had a patient recently that we just did a cesarean section on her, and she was hemorrhaging. I could not get the uterus to stop bleeding. What do you hate to hear when you're a surgeon and you're in that situation? It's the anesthetist student say to her supervisor, gee, I think something's wrong with the IV. The patient is bleeding from all of her IVs. So at that point, you call for fresh blood, and then you start to see clots form. God made the body in a wonderful way, and it really does work. So the fresh blood with the factors can turn your patient around. I want to move on to our next topic, but I'm spending more time on this because I think this is probably what you're going to see the most of. Clinical pearls, I would just again emphasize, can you see, can you feel? Do you need to go to the theater where you have better exposure, where you have better light? Do you need more helping hands? We talked about headlamps and ring forceps. When you can't see the apex of the laceration, you sew where you can see, and then you can move up or move forward to try to get those bleeders. Uterine balloons, packing balloons, they're available. They have directions in the box. A lot of wonderful people in the West will send those out to mission hospitals. If you have a uterine tamponade balloon, it's a balloon that you actually put up into the uterus and you blow it up with saline, and it tamponades that uterus for you. There are directions there. You can try that as well. The question is, when do you go to laparotomy? And this is not a talk about cesarean hysterectomy. There are things that you can do before you do a cesarean hysterectomy, but you always have to keep that in the back of your mind. Sometimes you have to cut the patient. Okay, I'm going to move on to bleeding in pregnancy. Bleeding can occur anytime during pregnancy, first, second, or third trimester. I've put there for you a little differential. First trimester hemorrhage and can be also quite impressive. Generally, when you have bleeding in pregnancy and you don't know you have an intrauterine pregnancy, what are you concerned about? Ectopic pregnancy. And I always tell my interns, every early pregnancy with bleeding is an ectopic until proven otherwise, because ectopic pregnancies rupture and they're very dangerous. For the next few slides, we're going to be talking about intrauterine pregnancies and miscarriages, spontaneous abortions with that. Second trimester becomes a little more complicated. You have to start considering things like placenta previa, when the placenta is over the cervix. Molar pregnancy, we see a lot of molar pregnancies where we live. And then in third trimester, which can sometimes be the scariest because you have a viable baby that you have to consider as well. Placenta previa is really a big problem, as well as abruption. Okay, some points on management of bleeding in pregnancy. The principles are the same as in any hemorrhage. Take your own pulse and then start to think about the ABCs. Do you have an ultrasound? Reed is going to talk to you about ultrasound. They really are not too hard to use, and they can help you out a lot. The umbilicus rule, you know what that is? If you can feel the uterus at the belly button, it's patients at least 20 weeks, okay? So you know you're out of the first trimester, usually at that point, unless you have fibroids. Keep in mind that you could be dealing with an unsafe abortion. This is becoming an escalating problem where I live in Kenya. Women are not forthcoming. If you have a woman who comes in who's bleeding and she is pregnant and she's not giving you a clear story, you need to think that there was a possibility that she attempted an abortion. And then you start to deal with the complications of that. Women do still use sticks. They also will try to use herbs, which can have all sorts of pretty bad consequences. I've seen people go into renal failure from trying to use herbs, and I've seen people use a lot of sticks in an attempt to do an abortion, and they perforate everything. They perforate their uterus, they perforate their bladder, they perforate their bowel. So keep that in the back of your mind. Always think about preparing for the theater and going for a procedure. Now, I don't know how many surgeons there are in this room. Again, I'm thinking more in terms of the family doctor here. Going back to the theater can be a scary thing, and I know that. But if you have a lady that is having a first or second trimester abortion, her cervix is open, she's bleeding a great deal with a product of conception, you can get back to the operating room, and with light, sometimes you can actually tease out the products of conception from the uterus without actually having to stick anything into the uterus. If you need to do a DNC, and using your little curettage again, an ultrasound will help you. And always, always, always drain the bladder. Misoprostol is great in first and second trimester to give to your patient to help the uterus contract down. And also doxycycline in those cases to cover your patient for infection. Remember, in the second trimester, a larger uterus is a larger problem, that the fetus has ossified bones at that point, and so it can be very difficult. You're actually having to extract the fetus. And at times when you're beyond 20 weeks, sometimes we actually have to do a hysterotomy. In the third trimester, I would just encourage you to not stick your fingers into the vagina in a third trimester pregnant patient who's bleeding, because you could have a placenta there. If you stick your fingers in the placenta, then you're going to have even more hemorrhage. So we think about a double setup, and that's going to the theater, and you can do your exam then to see what's going on, but you're also prepared to do a cesarean section. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit now about ruptured ectopic pregnancy. We don't see that much in the West anymore, because most women know they have an early diagnosis of pregnancy. If there is an ectopic, we recognize it before it ruptures. That's not the way it is in low-resource settings. Women come in with basically in shock. They've been at home, they've been pregnant, and they start to feel dizzy or unwell, and they collapse. Their family brings them into casualty, and they have a belly full of blood. So any woman, and if you remember anything from this talk, any woman from menarche to menopause can be pregnant. Please, please, please check a pregnancy test on every single patient who presents with bleeding or with a distended abdomen and pain, because you could be pregnant and you could be dealing with an ectopic, and you don't want to miss this. Now, where are ectopics usually? They're usually in the tube, in the ampullary portion. They can be out towards the fimbria, they can be more towards the uterus, at the cornea, they can be in the ovary and the cervix. But the good thing is that when you have an ectopic, usually it's just sitting up in a tube, and the tube becomes very fat, and it hemorrhages and bleeds, and it's easier to get to surgically. So management of ruptured ectopics. So again, as a family doc in my past, I was not very comfortable with the idea of going into the operating theater. But if you're the only one, and you have a patient that is unstable, there's nothing else you can do at that point to open the belly and to try to find the source of the bleeding, which we know is usually going to be a tube. I'm not going to take the time to go through this, but basically I would encourage you to consider doing a midline vertical incision over a fin steel if you're in a hurry and you don't have a lot of surgical skill. Because you're less likely to run into to problems with that, including adhesions in the belly. You can use simple clamps or hemostats, and you just cross over the tube. Okay, I'm going to move on to eclampsia. So preeclampsia is a very significant problem in the developing world. And again, we see a lot of it in the West too, but we're catching it early because we're seeing people every 2 to 4 weeks. That's not what we're doing in low resource settings in Africa. We are seeing people maybe once or twice for an antenatal care visit, if that. So what will happen is you'll have young patients that are very high risk, and they may see a doctor, and they may have a little bit of an elevated blood pressure at 30 weeks. They're put on antihypertensives because they have hypertension, and they're sent home. And that's when they come in, usually a couple weeks later, with grand mal seizures. So eclampsia, generalized seizures in a pregnant patient beyond 20 weeks in the absence of any other etiology. Know your blood pressure criteria for preeclampsia. That's going to be in your resource packet there. Proteinuria is always a part of it. Now, when I trained, it was the three-legged stool. It was blood pressure, protein, and edema. We've taken edema out of that, although I will say that if you see a patient, eclamptic patients, preeclamptic patients, have a characteristic look, and it's swelling in their face many times. So keep that in the back of your mind. So the patient comes in, again, it's an emergency situation. Usually people are panicked. Usually your midwives are panicking and your interns are panicking because seizures are scary things to see. The first thing that I can really encourage you with this is to focus on the mom. It's really hard when you have a woman at 40 weeks and you know the baby's heartbeat is down. You're listening with your Doptone or your fetoscope or you have an ultrasound, you see this. And you know the heartbeat is down, but you need to take care of the mom and stabilize the mom. The baby can be resuscitated in the uterus. This baby is usually a pretty healthy baby, and if we can take care of the mom and get her stabilized, get her seizures taken care of, get fluids on board, get oxygen on board, usually that baby will recover. Don't rush emergently to a cesarean section with an unstable mother. Take care of the mother first. The best drug for eclamptic seizures? It's magnesium. That's actually been shown now in studies. It's better than benzodiazepines. It's better than phenytoin. So if you don't have IV access, you can use magnesium IM. When you get IV access, you can start 1 to 2 grams an hour. What might be the problem with IV magnesium in a low resource setting? It can be dangerous. You can give too much of it and send someone into respiratory cardiac arrest. So I really encourage you to use magnesium IM unless you have a trained midwife staff. Now at Tenwick, we have trained midwife staff, and they're used to using magnesium. Put in the back of your mind, what do you give someone to reverse the effects of magnesium? Calcium, yeah, calcium gluconate. And you should always have that around if you're using magnesium. The other thing that I would encourage you is not to miss other diagnoses. Patients come in with all sorts of things. Cerebritis, abscess, meningitis is a big problem. So if a patient comes in having a seizure, doc, it's eclampsia, oh, but she has a temperature of 39 degrees Celsius, and she's been complaining of headache and chills for 2 days. It could be meningitis, it could be malaria. Also young people get brain tumors in Africa too, and we've seen that as well. So again, the question becomes, when do you go to cesarean section? Vaginal delivery is always the best thing for the mom and the baby if it can be done safely. So if you have a many times these women will be laboring. If you have a multiparous patient that has a cervix that is dilated and she's laboring, and the heartbeat's gone back up with some fluids and some oxygen, and now the mom's not having seizures, you can induce her and she can have a baby vaginally. If you're under 32, 34 weeks, if you have a very closed cervix and a 16, 17-year-old girl, you might need to plan for a cesarean section. I will mention, try to get a CBC, because what goes along with eclampsia? Preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome, okay? And that's a special subset of preeclampsia. It's a very severe form where you actually get hemolysis, elevation of your liver enzymes, and low platelets. And you don't want to go to cesarean section in a patient who has platelets of 25,000. So again, you have to focus on the mom, which can be very difficult at times. What do you do under 32 weeks, under 30 weeks? It's difficult. In the States, we can really work with babies as young as 23, 24 weeks. In many places in the world, babies simply cannot live outside of the mom really much under 32 weeks. At 10 week, we're pretty good with babies at 28 weeks, but we still have a problem with those as well. So you have to think, this mom is 26 weeks along. Do we give her a C-section and make her basically have a scar on her uterus, which has significant implications for her future childbearing, for a child that cannot live? In the United States, it's really a no-brainer. Of course we would, because a 26-weeker can do pretty well in the West. So you can give someone steroids, okay? You can give them a dose of steroids. We have dexamethasone at 10 week. But remember, you really need to move pretty quickly to delivery. We can't expectantly manage eclampsia, whereas with mild preeclampsia, and sometimes even severe preeclampsia, you can wait to get steroids on board for the baby. We can't do that as much with eclampsia. Okay, in the last 5-10 minutes, I want to talk a little bit about obstructed labor. Now, we'll talk about cesarean section, and then I put in here shoulder dystocia, which I call a special form of obstructed labor. That's something you may see, and it's something that a non-surgeon, you really can do a lot to deliver a healthy baby. Okay, so cesarean section. Now, I'm going to put my plug in here. Tomorrow, between 2 and 4, I've got some models that I'm going to be using to take people through a simulated cesarean section. So we can talk about all those issues as far as what kind of skin incision to make and how to make that incision, delivery of the baby, and how to repair everything. So if you're really interested in that, I think you should come by and we can sit around and we can have a tutorial on that. Because if you're going to be in a place, especially if you're a family doctor and there are no other surgical types around, you may be in a position where you might need to do a cesarean section. So I'd like to help you review that tomorrow. So that's my plug for that. We'll also be doing practicing of suture techniques. So you can work on, if you're doing any incisions on the head, neck, or hands, you can work on suturing techniques for that as well. Okay, shoulder dystocia. What is it? Basically, I call them football babies. The baby is too big to come under the symphysis pubis. You have the bony pelvis. The baby's got these shoulders, and the head comes out. Turtle sign, right? The head comes out. Oop. Goes back in again. When you see that as an obstetrician, you know you're headed for some troubled water. Also, we see it a lot in Africa because we have young mothers. So you can have a baby that's 6 pounds, but a tiny 14-year-old little girl, and her pelvis just not big enough to let that baby through. So what happens is the baby's head comes out and nothing else. What's your temptation at that point? Pull harder. If I just pull harder, I can get the baby out. That's actually just the wrong thing to do. So let me go through a couple of these points. So stop pulling on the baby. Again, people are panicking at this point. You need to be calm. Call for help. You want at least three people around to help you. You should at least have your midwife and yourself. Move the patient into the ideal. Now she's panicking too. Her baby is delivered. The head is out. So you want to try to calm her, move her to the edge of the table, assess the need for an episiotomy, encourage a medial lateral episiotomy. Why? Because if you do a midline, you have an increased risk of going through the rectum, and that's a whole other problem. You've given someone a fourth degree in a low-resource setting. We try to avoid that, but sometimes we can't. Avoid fundal pressure. Again, if you're pushing on a block there, you're not going to do any good. The head's going to keep going in and out, but the shoulders aren't going to come. So helper, if you like these little helps for remembering, call for help, evaluate for an episiotomy. We're going to go through these maneuvers. Nick Roberts, suprapubic pressure, enter into the vagina, try to deliver the posterior shoulder, and then the Gaskins maneuver. So patient at the end of the bed, and if any of y'all want to come by tomorrow, we can actually review this at our simulation too. But you're hyperextending her legs up onto her abdomen, and somebody is pushing from above to try to dislodge that shoulder. That actually opens up the bony structures, and it will help you deliver the baby. Then you can gently take the baby's head, and you can pull down and see if you can get that anterior shoulder to deliver. The Woods corkscrew maneuver and the Rubin maneuver, these are all just variations of putting your hand in and trying to get the shoulder and trying to basically unscrew the baby. So pushing the baby to the left or pushing the baby to the right to try to get that anterior shoulder loose to deliver. The Gaskins maneuver, very difficult to do with women with epidurals. But women where I work don't have epidurals. So you can get them on their hands and knees. Sometimes that will dislodge the shoulder. Other things you can do, you can break the baby's clavicles, you can do a symphysiotomy, and you can do something called the Zavanelli maneuver, which is where you take the baby's head and you push it back in and you go for an emergent abdominal delivery. This does not have usually a very good outcome, but it has been attempted and it can work. So in your mind, I would like you to do, if you're going to be especially a family doc or a generalist that's not used to doing this, memorize this and go over it, because when you're in the middle of a situation, you don't have time to think it through. You start the clock, you look at where you are, you call for help, do an episiotomy, even though it's soft tissue, sometimes it can give you just a little more space. You do your positioning of the patient, Nick Roberts, suprapubic pressure, think about internal maneuvers, try to go in and just deliver that posterior arm. If you can feel where the arm is, you bring the arm out over the baby, and then that will reduce the shoulders and it will allow you to deliver, or simply try to move the shoulders from side to side. Roll the patient and then think about the things we don't want to have to think about, which is like going to the theater. Some final thoughts. Remember, pray at all times and all places. I have been in some really tough spots where I didn't know what to do. I was in over my head. God cares about you. He sent you to where you're going, and he cares more about you and more about that patient than we can ever know. He will give you what you can handle, and he will send help. So I encourage you to remember that and don't be afraid, but just move forward in that courage. For our surgeons out there, I want you to remember that there are other things that you can do other than taking out the uterus. Okay, remember your uterotonics. We do hysterectomies on teenagers and 20-somethings, and that's awful. It's awful anywhere in the world. Particularly, though, where I work, it has many implications for your family and socially. That are a little bit different. So from embryouterotonic agents, things to do before you take out the uterus. And for our non-surgeons, remember, I used to be one, remember that surgery, the knife, may be the only thing that stands between that patient and death. Now, first, do no harm. You'd never want to be reckless. But if you are it, okay, in this game of tag here, if you're it and the patient is going to die, like you have a ruptured ectopic, she's unstable with a belly full of blood, use your best judgment and do what you can do. And again, tomorrow I will be around. I love teaching. I love teaching basic surgery. So come by if you have any questions, and I'll take you through my little model, and we can talk about using the knife and doing some abdominal incisions for these patients if you are there and you need help. Okay. Just briefly, resources. I really recommend WHO. What I've given you in your book is a manual. It's a modified manual that we use for our interns at Tenwick. It can be very helpful. But check out World Health Organization. They have great references online. I also agree UpToDate is an excellent resource. Open access articles, the American Family Physician has a lot of those online you can look at. Check out the Global Library of Women's Health, and that's under glowm.com. That has a lot of downloaded resources, and that's all going to be in your packet there. And then if you want a little book to carry, and you're worried about your luggage, you don't want to have too much weight, this is a little book. It's Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Infertility. It's a handbook for clinicians. It's a little red book we all carried around during our residency. You can get it in many different venues. Amazon.com has it. You can order it, and it's very small and helpful. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.